on Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and I have with us tonight Ron Honeyhanky. Did I say your name right, Ron?
Close enough. Dr. Ron is what a lot of people say.
Well, before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about you, how you came to do what you do, and where we can find you. And tonight we're going to be talking about nutrient laboratory testing and the benefit of taking nutritional medicine for illnesses as opposed to pharmaceuticals. So why don't you tell us a little bit about you?
Well, if people want to see a picture of me, they can go to my clinic where I work, RiordanClinic.com. It's RIORDAN clinic, all one word, .org, we're a nonprofit organization. And they can click around on that website and kind of see quite a bit about our whole program. But I'm a family physician. I'm in Wichita, Kansas, and I've been the chief medical officer at the Riordan Clinic for the past 7 years, going on 8. Our founder, Dr. Hugh Riordan, died about in 2004, and he started the clinic in 1975. And so the clinic is dedicated to helping people find the underlying causes of their illness as opposed to just simply treating symptoms. So we use a laboratory. We started out as a laboratory. We are Medicare certified, CLIA inspected, and we run a battery, quite an extensive battery of tests on new patients, especially patients who have complex illnesses. And that's typically who we see, are people who have been through the medical gauntlet and they've been to all the various specialists. They've been on all the medicines. They're on several medicines and they're still not getting results. And they have the feeling that people are just trying to cover up their symptoms rather than trying to help them correct the underlying causes. So that's a big part of what we're attempting to do, is a kind of detective process looking for the underlying causes of chronic illness.
And where is that site? Can you just say that again, please?
It's www.RiordanClinic, RIORDAN clinic, .org, O-R-G.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure everybody got that.
Yeah.
Okay, tell me why you think that we should treat, just your basic description of why we should look to nutritional treatments as opposed to pharmaceutical treatments to treat disease such as maybe diabetes or cancer or cardiovascular disease. Why should we look there?
Okay, my good friend and co-author, Jack Chalom, just recently published an article in Alternative and Complementary Medicine that was entitled Nutritional Therapy as First-Line Therapy. And he made a number of different arguments in favor of this. Number one, we are biochemically based cellular creatures. I mean, basically, any living organism is composed of living cells, and cells function by virtue of nutrients. And people do consume macronutrients, which are your foods, proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. But in order for those macronutrients to be properly metabolized into energy and structure and hormones and organization, you need these cofactors called vitamins and minerals and coenzymes and amino acids and all the various individual nutrients that serve to keep the cellular factory moving right along. We are very complex cellular organisms, but interestingly enough, there is a unity in nature. All living organisms that are composed of cells have a basic common denominator in terms of how they generate energy and how they reproduce and how they protect themselves from infection and injury and those kinds of things. And so when people eat whole foods, real foods, generally unprocessed foods, they are getting everything that that organism that they're consuming, whether it's a plant or an animal or a fungus or whatever, that allowed that animal to survive. And so if we eat whole foods, we get all those biological chemicals that help us maintain, repair, and energize our systems. But when you add new chemicals to the mix, such as pharmaceuticals or toxic chemicals, such as all the pesticides and plastics and the various things that have been introduced to the world in the last 100 years or so, you now have a significant blocking effect, and that's basically how pharmaceuticals work. They block certain enzyme systems or certain functions of certain organs in order to achieve results. Generally, the results control symptoms. Some results can be life-saving. I always use the example of if you come to the emergency room in congestive heart failure and you've got, you know, a big sodium overload and you're basically drowning in your own fluids when you're in pulmonary edema, the doctor giving you a diuretic, which is a poison to the tubule of the kidney, which prevents the reabsorption of sodium, and your body starts pouring sodium out in your urine, that's going to save your life. And so in acute care medicine, there's no question that medicines can be very helpful, and I do use medicines. But most of the illnesses that Western civilization, pretty much the whole world now, is using are aimed at trying to treat chronic illnesses. And in a sense, they might achieve some short-term relief of symptoms, but almost always at the expense of the long-term health of the individual taking those medicines. So we look upon nutrition as a better long-term therapy, and now with the modern tools of the laboratory and the knowledge that we've gained about nutrients in the care of chronic illness, to me it's always seemed like such a shame that there's not more nutritional medicine education given to the medical students, but the medical schools are largely financed by the pharmaceutical companies, and they have gotten such a grip on the consciousness of Western society that it's pretty tough to compete, though there is a major grassroots movement occurring where people are beginning to recognize that long-term use of medication is possibly, this may be a little bit of a stretch, but it's certainly a big part of why modern medicine is just getting bigger and bigger, and our problems are multiplying rather than getting better. So that's kind of a long answer, but that's basically why I would always recommend using a nutritional approach if you can to help you solve your chronic illnesses.
Normally, I have a book that somebody's written, so I have a big, thick piece of material to study. But this time, I have these two articles, so I'm going to pull my questions from these two articles you sent me. But feel free to talk about other things, because obviously there's more than just two articles, okay?
Oh, yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask you about is pharmaceuticals obviously don't sell nutrients because they're not patentable.
Correct.
But is it true that they base their whatever it is that they do make because they do research using nutritious food, I guess, nutrients, vitamins, supplements, and figure out what thing works best and then make the closest thing they can so that they can patent it and make money? Is that kind of how they do what they do?
That's looking at it in a pretty positive light.
I'm not trying to say pharmaceuticals here.
I think a lot of pharmaceuticals, basically the word drug or two drug comes from I forget what the exact word is, but it means to, you know, give a plant-based substance to, or to treat with a plant-based substance. And things like digitalis, you know, is a derivative of foxglove. And so, you know, the original drugs were herbs. And then what happened is the pharmaceutical companies then broke down the constituencies of the herbs. For example, foxglove, they broke it down to, digitalis. And then now it's a medication called digoxin, and it's a chemical. It's no longer part of a plant. There's a big difference. You know, people think of herbs, maybe they're like natural drugs, but there has been research. For example, there's been two institutions that have been looking at just one herb, ginger root, and so far they've identified over 250 phytonutrients that are found in ginger root. And so herbs are very complex conglomerations of phytochemicals that act on the body in numerous ways that have, more often than not, if they are a natural herb that has a traditional use medicinally, they oftentimes work in what's called an adaptogenic way, which, if you've got high blood pressure, it brings your blood pressure down. If you've got low blood pressure, it brings your blood pressure up. And so that's not like any drug. You know, drugs, mm-hmm. once again, act as poisons on certain receptor sites. And these receptor sites, when they're poisoned, they bring an out-of-balance system back into balance. But over time, there's always long-term side effects. And that's interesting that in the last five or so years that the drug company commercials have become really popular. That's where I've kind of seen a lot of people becoming somewhat disillusioned with medications, because one-third of the commercial is about what the drug does, and two-thirds are about the side effects. And then to add to that, there are more and more large law firms that are getting into the business of taking people who have these side effects and creating class action lawsuits against the drug companies, which for many of the drug companies, the profits are so great that they're willing to go ahead and do payoffs of the people calling in rather than taking it to trial and having it revealed that, you know, serious side effects are occurring. They mostly report these in the insert, package insert. The side effects are listed in terms of percentages and whatnot, and they probably do occur in those percentages, but there is also a number of people that have very serious side effects that are often not recorded. And if they are becoming more common, then they're put in a black box. But very often the doctors will just say, well, these are so rare, you know, it's just the risk of that you're going to have to take. And so so people kind of have this false sense of security that if they take a drug, it's all been tested by the FDA and everything's going to be fine. But if they fall into those percentages that the serious side effects happen to, they become very debilitated. They can sometimes get a settlement out of the deal, but they're taking some pretty big chances with drugs. And then where I really got into this was I was the medical director of a nursing home for 5 years. And it's one thing to take one drug that has a list of side effects, but when you're elderly and you're in a nursing home and doctors on calls call in drugs without really knowing your whole history, it's very easy to get into what we call polypharmacy, which is, it's not unusual for an elderly person in a nursing home to be on 10 medications. Mm-hmm. And when you take into consideration the loss of reserve in their organ systems, such as their kidneys and their lungs and their heart and whatnot, they're very susceptible to side effects. And unfortunately, because a lot of doctors assume that side effects are very rare, when an elderly patient does get an adverse effect, more often than not, they're given another drug that treats that side effect. So that's why the polypharmacy seems to get worse instead of better.
That's kind of what I wanted you to explain, because sometimes doctors say, well, they made this from such and such drug, so I wanted people to understand that with the pharmaceuticals, you're going to get those side effects, and with the food, obviously, you're not going to get those side effects. Okay, so thank you very much. Very good description there. I'm going to go back to your article now, and before we go on, I'd like for you to talk about, tell me what rate-limiting factors are. What does that mean? Substrates, what does that mean to us?
Well, everything in the body works, all the biochemistry in the body is controlled by the DNA. And so the DNA is in the nucleus of your cell, but it's really kind of like a program on your hard drive. It's just sitting there not doing anything until you click the little app that activates the program, and then the program comes up on your screen, and you can do your word processor, you can do your spreadsheet, or you can connect to the internet. But in a similar way, the DNA just sits there until something happens at the cell membrane. Some receptor is activated, let's say by a toxin or by a hormone, and then a signal is sent through the liquid part of the cell called the cytoplasm. And it starts a process to where the DNA begins making, it begins connecting amino acids to make special proteins called enzymes. And these enzymes start to make various things, whether it's other enzymes or cell, other structures within the cell or antibodies, immunoglobulins, those kinds of things. And so everything kind of happens by virtue of these enzymes, but these enzymes always need cofactors in order to give them the proper configuration. And so, for example, let's just take hemoglobin. You need iron in order for your hemoglobin molecules to work properly. And in plants, you need magnesium to make chlorophyll work properly. And so here's a mineral that, you know, here are minerals that are needed in order for your body to work properly. And so that's true also for certain vitamins. For example, you cannot make neurotransmitters properly. You know, you can take tryptophan. People know that tryptophan is converted to serotonin. And so you can use tryptophan, 5-HTP, as an alternative to an antidepressant if you want to, you know, want to help your body make more serotonin. But you really need B6 in order for what's called methylation to occur properly, in order to methylate that tryptophan and convert it into serotonin, and then you have to methylate it again to convert the serotonin into melatonin in order to sleep properly. And so there's all these chemical reactions that require these cofactors, and guess where you get those? From food, from whole foods. And the more you process foods, the more you take out the wholeness of the food. For example, if you have whole grain and you process it into white flour, you've just lost 50% of the wholeness value. If you have orange juice and you make it in, I'm sorry, whole oranges and you make it into orange juice, maybe you've lost 10 or 20%. But then if you make that orange juice into orange drink, you've lost 90% of these little nutrients. And if you make orange pop, you've lost 99.9% of the nutrients. And yet there's a nice picture of an orange on the can, and people think they're somehow getting something that we used to call oranges. And even the oranges themselves, because the soil is not what it used to be due to depletion of the soil or over, you know, using very simple fertilizers that do not have the mineral content, the value of food is not quite what it used to be. And this is why there's a tendency for people to suggest organic or to use foods that come from farms that are trying to replenish the soils or rotate the crops. So all these things are adding to the depletion of the food supply of Americans that's causing them to use up or to not get what they need in terms of substrate in order to run the biochemistry of their cells. And so consequently, their cells start to malfunction, and this malfunctioning occurs oftentimes in what we call syndromes or complex symptoms. So when people come in and they have chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia, there's not one drug that you can give that person, and there's not one vitamin or one nutrient that you can give that person. You have to look at the total disruption of their the ecology of their systems and find out that they have been malnourished for many years and that the process of renourishing them is pretty complicated, takes time. It's not a quick fix, and that goes against the grain of how most Americans think. We think we can go into the ER, and somehow the doctor there is going to give us something to make us good as new. And it just doesn't happen that way. And so consequently, we have people who wander through the medical system with a lot of unknown symptoms, and the doctors get very mad at them, and they begin to doubt themselves, and they get very debilitated, they run out of money, they end up on the street, or they have all kinds of things happen to them because they don't have a simple disease. They have a syndrome, a complex syndrome that very often involves malnutrition, toxicity, hormonal imbalance, yeast overgrowth, all kinds of things going on because of this huge complex disruption of the food supply. So we have a lot of chronic inflammatory illnesses because of the food supply, because the nutrients in the food used to help regulate the inflammatory system, and now the inflammatory system is tilted way in the direction of inflammation. So that's why most diagnoses you'll get from a doctor have an itis on the end of the word. Dermatitis, colitis, arteritis, arthritis, meningitis, they're all inflammatory disruptions of the balance of the inflammation system because of this complex disruption that's going on in our environment.
One thing I'd like to ask you about is people who are on multiple drugs, let's just say congestive heart disease. As soon as somebody starts taking that statin, I always say don't take those statins. Within 10 years, if you do, you're going to have congestive heart failure because those statins and the diuretics deplete your vitamins and minerals. And I don't think people get that. So I'd like for you to talk a minute how. And I've got a bunch more questions for you. Plus, I want to give you time to talk about whatever you want to talk about. And it's 8:20, so just keep that in mind. I'd like for you to talk about how drugs rob you of nutrition.
Well, the statins are very, very popular because they.
And you don't
appear...
have to stick to statins, by the way.
Well, that's a good one, though. That's a good one to illustrate the point. Statins are very, very popular. There's even doctors have said we ought to put statins in the water. And the reason they're saying that is because heart disease or artery disease is the number one killer in Western civilization. It's actually, some people say it's now number two and that cancer is taking over. But it turns out the risk factors for cancer and the risk factors for heart disease are very similar. So let's just for now, let's stick with heart disease because that's a lot of people go in and have their cholesterol checked, and if it's high, the doctors right away want to put them on a statin drug, and it seems like a really quick fix, and that there are some statistics within these large random controlled trials that make it look like, wow, this is great. Here's people that are taking statin drugs and they're living longer and having fewer heart attacks, and so here we go. This is what we need. This looks like the magic bullet. This is what medicine has basically become famous for in the last 100 years, because with the advent of antibiotics, it looked like medicine had wiped out infectious disease on the planet. Of course, we know that's not true. We now have all kinds of infectious disease epidemics going on. Some of them, of course, are viral, you know, the AIDS epidemic, which is still raging on in various parts of the world, including the United States. It's a viral illness, and then we all had the big bird flu scare and whatnot. And so infectious disease has not been wiped out. And, of course, there we're trying to look for vaccinations to be the answer. And, of course, that's a whole other story we can talk about in just a minute. But coming back to this notion that you can use a chemical to change the course of a complex illness like heart disease, I think all you can do is you can change the course temporarily. And so if you're someone in your early 20s, 30s, or 40s, and you've got really high cholesterol, and you go on a statin drug, it does, in a sense, buy you some help. in the sense that by lowering these really high cholesterol levels, it does seem to slow down the inflammatory changes that occur in the arteries, and that appears to be good. But I was just reading an article last night about how people who are on statin drugs are clearly at a higher risk for developing diabetes later on. Plus, now we know that that congestive heart failure can certainly happen to people who have been on statins. And then there's all the known side effects that they mention in the commercials, like memory problems and muscle aches and pains and change of personality and fatigue. There's a lot of different things that can happen when you're on statins. And again, most doctors tend to ignore the side effects and just say, oh, it's just stress, don't worry about it, because look how much better your cholesterol is. And that's what I think happens, is the medical profession has become a bunch of technicians, and we look at numbers. We're not paying attention so much to how people are performing and the quality of their lives. We're just basically looking at the fact that a statin drug will dramatically reduce their cholesterol, because what it's doing is poisoning an enzyme system. Now we're back to substrates. It poisons the HMG-CoA enzyme, which is the enzyme in the liver that makes cholesterol. And the doctors will rightly and correctly say, well, you need that because lifestyle alone will not lower your cholesterol. And that's true for a lot of people, but a lot of people are never really all that serious about changing their lifestyle. Some people are, and they still have high cholesterol. There's genetic things that can make it stay high. But a lot of these people are not that serious, and a lot of people who go on statin drugs and see their cholesterol come down see it as a kind of license to go out there and eat even worse, or to eat whatever they want, because I'm on a statin, so therefore I'm invincible, which they're not. But what happens is this HMG-CoA enzyme is the enzyme that makes CoQ10, and CoQ10 is a very important vitamin-like substance that your mitochondria, which are the parts of your cells that generate energy, they need that CoQ10 to get oxygen in to burn the sugar glucose in order to make the energy, the ATP energy that your body needs to run. But when you start losing your CoQ10, which three organ systems are going to be the most affected? It's the ones that have the highest number of mitochondria in their cells, which are the heart, the muscles, and the brain. And so people who are on this run a risk of getting tired and developing congestive heart failure down the road. They get muscle achiness and pain, and their brain doesn't work as good. They have personality changes. Their memory's not as good. They just don't function like they used to, and it happens very slowly. These are very slow developing side effects, and so you tend to think you're getting older, you're not really sure what's going on, and you don't have a lot of support from doctors because they don't know what else to give you. They're pretty much convinced that the best thing they can do for you is lower your cholesterol, even though we now know that half the people that get heart attacks have a normal cholesterol. So then they'll say, well, wait a minute, no, it's not that. It's the LDL cholesterol. It's the bad cholesterol. And now we know that the LDL cholesterol, whether or not it's dangerous, depends upon the particle size. And the particle size depends upon how high your triglycerides are and how much of the protective cholesterol you have, the HDL. So if you have a really good ratio, a low triglycerides and a high HDL, you're going to have the large, buoyant particles, which are not harmful at all. They're protective. So LDL is not always bad. So just when someone has a high LDL and a doctor throws them on a statin drug, they may not be doing the best thing for their patients. But there is this belief among physicians that patients really can't change their lifestyle. Patients are really pretty dumb and don't know how to correct things. And doctors themselves don't know how to use nutrition to have an impact on this whole scenario. So unfortunately, it's creating a huge situation because there are so many people on statins now because of the widespread incidence of obesity. 70% of Americans are overweight. Obesity causes inflammation, which causes insulin resistance, which causes a high blood pressure, weight gain in the center part of your body, high cholesterol, and high blood sugar levels. This is the so-called metabolic syndrome, or what what is also known as prediabetes. And the reason I know about this is because my good friend Jack Chalam and I wrote a book called Stop Prediabetes Now. And that's strictly, or could be strictly, looked upon as a lifestyle illness that's correctable by working and disciplining yourself to follow good nutritional guidelines and to get the right amount of exercise and sleep and all the things that everyone knows to do, but we just don't do it in this culture. And so consequently, we have an epidemic of prediabetes that's being treated with statin drugs, antihypertensive medicines, and diabetes medicines. Because doctors know how to prescribe those, but they do not know how to prescribe lifestyle change, and they do not believe that lifestyle change even works. So we have a system, we have a huge system of failure going on right now.
Certainly, absolutely. I have a couple questions here, three of them that I'm going to tell you before I forget. And
okay.
Then I want to talk about epigenetic regulation of genes, because I found that portion of this article very interesting. I have some questions there, but so I'm going to ask you these three questions, and you can answer them how you like. I want to know, for the bad cholesterol, if you have the small particles, how do you address that nutritionally?
Well,
let me go ahead and tell you all of them.
Oh, go ahead. Okay, go ahead.
The diabetes, the sugar problem, is that something that you can treat with cinnamon, or is that something that you have to take many things to fix, like chromium or something like that? And then you made a statement, surgery. Why do people need to supplement more when they have surgery? Because I don't know of a single surgeon that's going to recommend you take some good nutritional supplements when you have surgery.
I know one, and
questions?
That was... I have one. I know one that was my mentor. I have a pretty high respect for good surgeons, because most of them are pretty practical, and they do think about this. Not all of them, and maybe that's the exception for the ones that do, but I know a lot of them are a little easier to talk to, because they're not just armchair doctors. They actually are in there dealing with people in the blood and guts, so to speak, of medical care. My mentor was a general surgeon who, before he became a surgeon, was a farmer. And frankly, I use this metaphor all the time, is that if doctors would think more like farmers, we would be in a lot better shape. Farmers know that you can't just, unlike a college student who can goof off all semester and in the last 3 or 4 days prior to the final, cram and still pass the test, a farmer knows that he has to do everything in the right sequence at the right time, work very hard. He has to plow the field, cultivate the field, plant the seeds, fertilize, all the various things that farmers do to get a good crop. They have to harvest it. They have to bring it to market. They have to plan for the next year. There's so much that goes into farming. That's the way I look at health, that health is a multidimensional event, that you cannot give someone a pill and say, here, now this is going to make you healthy. So talking about diabetes, cinnamon is a great thing and chromium is helpful, but frankly, diabetes is a lifestyle illness, and all those things are necessary. And this is part of why we do the extensive laboratory testing that we do, because in a sense, back to the farming analogy, people are bringing in their body as a kind of soil sample, and we're going to look at all their nutrients, because people that are diabetic, not all of them are low in chromium. Diabetes does turn out to be, as Julian Whitaker describes it, a nutrient wasting disease, and a lot of them have multiple deficiencies, but they don't all turn out to be the same. So you have to treat the biochemical uniqueness of each individual, and their illness may be different from the other 9 diabetics that you saw that day. And so you have to kind of respect that uniqueness and try to work with it on an individual basis. And so, but even that is useless if people are going to go back out and eat crummy foods. And so still food, better nutrition, and adequate exercise, these are foundational things that people need to do if they want to get their diabetes under control. And I'm going to say one other thing. If they're overweight, they've got to lose that visceral layer of fat. Visceral fat is the abnormal fat that builds up around the organs that triggers all the inflammation that we see in diabetes. People who are diabetic have elevated CRPs. They're inflamed. This inflammation oftentimes centers in the liver. And the one medicine that helps them, metformin, turns out it works predominantly in the liver. But if people would do liver detox, if they would lose their visceral body fat, if they would get their exercise program going, eat whole foods, cut down on their portion size, get adequate sleep, take the nutrients that they're low in, then they can reverse that illness, get their hormones balanced. All these things are necessary for a diabetic to really turn things around and for their various particles to come back to the normal size. You can use medicines to force the particles back to a better size, but again, if they haven't changed their lifestyle, oftentimes the side effects of the medicines will start to gang up on the person, and they'll start having other problems that will tend to get in the way of making the fundamental lifestyle changes that are necessary.
So are you saying that if you keep your liver clean, and I'm assuming that means the gallbladder and your gut too, that that will help with that particle size problem?
Yeah, there was an interesting, I had a patient send me an email yesterday. You know, one of the words that Dr. Reardon coined that I think is so important for doctors is the word co-learner. And, you know, a lot of time the doctor thinks, so I've been to medical school and I go to my continuing medical education conferences, so I know everything I need to know. And if I don't know it, deeply involved in their illnesses and are combing the internet and reading books and articles and stuff and trying different things. And so this patient sent me a very interesting abstract and article on the importance of gut flora, that people, that they can take animals and use antibiotics and wipe out their gut flora, and lo and behold, they start becoming diabetic. And if they put the gut flora back in, if they re-inoculate the good bacteria, which is very important in terms of liver health. If you've got crummy bacteria in your gut and you're getting poorly digested food.
I don't know what, you're moving or something and it's cutting you out.
I'm sorry. Okay, I'll stop moving.
I don't know what it is. The phone just cuts out.
I wonder if I need to switch phones.
You're fine. It just did it twice.
Is that okay? Now. Okay,
yeah,
I'll stop.
Fine.
I'm sitting in a chair. Okay. Is that better?
Yep, that's good.
Okay, so what he was saying about his gut flora, that if you have the right gut flora, that has a big bearing on your liver health. And so taking a liver detox herb is good, but you also want to make sure you have the right probiotics in your gut and not have a proliferation of yeast and fungi in your gut. And that all that can make a difference in terms of your blood sugar regulation.
What about your gallbladder?
There are a lot of people that recommend the gallbladder flush because the gallbladder is a kind of, it's kind of a reservoir, and everything that your liver filters out of your blood, the liver is kind of like your oil filter, except you can't change it. So your body filters out a lot of stuff from your liver and it goes into the bile, and then the bile goes into the gut, and you hopefully eliminate some of that, but a lot of that sludge can build up in your gallbladder, and so there's many people who have kind of toxic gallbladders, and so the liver gallbladder flush for some people can be very dramatic in terms of helping them.
Well, I have to tell you this: I did that the other day. I did a liver gallbladder flush. I passed overnight. I passed 2.5 quarts of gallstones. And I know this, it's disgusting, but it's because I used a sieve, and I poured it all in quart jars to see how much it was, and it was 2.5 quarts of stones overnight. I can't tell you the difference that I felt the next day.
Yeah, no, it's very dramatic for a lot of people, and there's quite a few websites that talk about the importance of doing that.
Now, I could ask you a million specific questions, but I'm not going to do that. You got to come back so I can ask those specific questions. So I want to talk, because I'd love to ask you, what do you use to do this and what do you use to do that, but I won't do that tonight, because I want you to talk about the genes for a minute. And then I want you to talk about lab testing. But this article indicates that you can turn genes on and off, like, say, for breast cancer, by using folic acid and selenium, for example. Is that what that's saying? Am I reading that right?
Yeah, there was a big kind of promise. You know, we've now decoded the human genome, and so supposedly this was going to be the breakthrough in medicine. And there are a few things that have happened as a result of it, but overall, the surprising thing is that we humans don't have that many genes compared to some other species, and yet, so how do we get humans out of just a smaller number of genes? And it turns out that the environment that our genes are in has more to do with how they express than just some sort of internal code. It has to do with environmental factors, and this is what we call epigenetics. It's the environment in which the cells live and how they are. The membrane is one author says that we should spell that as membrain. There are thousands of receptors on every cell membrane that's constantly sensing the environment, and depending upon what's going on in the environment, it will send signals to the DNA to express different enzymes and different chemicals, biochemicals, to help the body be more adaptive to that particular environment. So it turns out that the epigenetics of our DNA may be more important than the genetic code itself.
So faulty genes is really not I guess it could be hereditary, because if you were born nutritionally deficient, then it would be. But faulty genes is really a nutritional deficiency. Is that what you're saying?
No. The genes are still faulty. Like, there's a couple examples I can use. For example, there is a gene that makes an enzyme called L-glutenolactase oxidase. And that is the enzyme that converts glucose into vitamin C. And all humans, that gene has mutated and is no longer functional. And so humans and primates and guinea pigs can no longer make their own vitamin C. So consequently, we have to get vitamin C in our diet or as a supplement. The problem is that most authorities think that just a very small amount, 60 to 100 milligrams, is all you need a day to prevent scurvy. And that's probably true in terms of preventing scurvy, but there are a lot of other chronic degenerative diseases that require much higher amounts of vitamin C. And so and we need that in certain instances, especially when we're sick or injured or stressed. We need more vitamin C than this 60 to 100 milligrams. And plus, given the fact that the diets have become so process, there's even less vitamin C than there used to be. And so consequently, that's one example. There's another one called methyl tetrahydrofolate, which is a type of folic acid that some people have a gene that has mutated, and they don't make enough of that, or they need a lot more than just the average person. And if they don't get it, then they're more prone to depression, they're more prone to maybe cancer, certainly. Mothers that are low in certain types of folic acid, the babies are more prone to birth defects like neurotube defects. And so if we would correct the nutritional environment of those people, if we could identify them and correct that nutritional environment, their epigenetic environment, then the consequences of having that genetic defect will never seriously affect their lives.
Wow. So one more question, and then I want to talk about testing. In this article that you provided somewhere, it was talking about folate and breast cancer. Is that any kind of breast? You know, there are different kinds. There's the estrogen-related kind. There's, all different kinds. Is that for any kind of breast cancer or just a specific kind?
Well,
I get a lot of people that write me about I need help with breast cancer.
Yeah, well, we're now up to like 1 in 7 women have had breast. My wife has had breast cancer, and so it's getting to be very all too common. And so that's why I was saying earlier that we used to say heart disease was the number one killer, and I think it was just this last year that cancer overtook heart disease as the number one killer. Any cancer, I mean, there are patterns of nutrient deficiencies that are sometimes associated with certain types of cancers, and folic acid, CoQ10, there's a couple other ones that have been roughly associated with breast cancer, but there's some very strong evidence in terms of vitamin D deficiency in breast cancer. Mm-hmm. The problem is that it depends upon your genetics in terms of whether or not you have one of these mutations. It depends upon your stress level, the environmental toxins that you've been exposed to in your life, how well you eat or how poorly you eat. Did you nurse your baby or didn't you? Do you drink everything out of plastic bottles? Do you microwave in plastic? There's a bunch of different environmental factors that go into every case of breast cancer, and it creates a huge degree of variation. And so therefore it makes it difficult to do these giant, 40,000 women, the nurses study, for example, we try to look in this large study and out of that try to figure out what are the risk factors for such and such disease. So what we're trying to do at our clinic is study the individual and see if we can determine from their nutrient levels, are there any nutrient deficiencies that are showing up on a consistent basis or in the affected individual that we can correct that will help their body heal the injury or the illness or the cancer or the heart disease. And so we use the lab as a kind of tool to do a biochemical biopsy of their chemistry so that we can see what's going on with them as a unique person. And then as we correct that, very often it promotes a self-healing process, a self-regulatory process that may not be the only thing they need to do, but it certainly can be a very powerful adjunct in the care of their cancer.
So let's talk about lab testing just a minute. Many people are going to say they're not accurate at any given moment, that they can change right now from tomorrow. So that may or may not be true, but...
Well, there we have to make the distinction between accuracy and variability. And I do tell people that when I do their lab testing, it is somewhat of a snapshot for that day, though I'm pretty impressed that even a year later, the information that I've gleaned is still giving me useful hints or ideas about how to proceed in their care. The accuracy is another thing. Variability is one thing. Accuracy is a different thing. As I mentioned to you earlier, we are a Medicare certified lab. So there is something called CLIA, which is an organization that assesses the accurateness of any laboratory and whether or not it's well run and is it safe. And so every year we have a CLIA inspection, and we are always given high praise for the fact that we have either zero or minor deficiencies that are easily corrected, partly because Dr. Reardon knew that there was going to be criticism for laboratory testing, frankly because it's not done that. I mean, most doctors have no idea how to interpret nutritional tests. And unless you've actually been in a clinic where they're commonly done, and I've worked at the Reardon Clinic for 23 years, and I will attest to you the value. Now, granted, they can be expensive, and it's not like you have to use nutrient testing. You can shotgun people with vitamins and a lot of various things. You can use your knowledge to kind of guide your recommendations. But I can guarantee you when people see their results and you explain to them how these results relate to their illness and what they need to take to correct them and plan to retest them down the road to prove that they really have gotten better in their levels, these people are much more compliant in taking their vitamins, and they're much more directed towards a result rather than just kind of walking out the door with a bag full of vitamins without really a true game plan as to how to bring equilibration back to their biochemistry.
I have two questions now. Is everybody's range the same?
No,
do you know what I mean when I say that?
Yeah, yeah.
The same range of normal, is that for everybody?
Right, and you know, and I will allow, and there is a field of thought called metabolic typing, which basically says that there are different metabolic types. There's people have used the blood typing. People have used, are you a fast oxidizer or a slow oxidizer? Are you parasympathetic dominant or sympathetic dominant? There's a number of things you can do to type the metabolism of the individual, and maybe certain metabolic types do well with certain nutrients and not so well with other nutrients. I think that deserves more study. But in the meantime, I can pretty much tell you that if you're low in certain nutrients, if a key nutrient is low, I always use the example of the football team. If you've got a really bad left tackle, you know, there's going to be someone coming through and getting the quarterback every time he goes back to pass. It's going to create a weakness. And so, in general, we're trying to identify where those gaps are in an effort to provide adequate team of substrate to the individual who's got the chronic illness and trying to get well. It's not the only thing we do, but it seems to be an important part of a comprehensive natural intervention in terms of people that have these complex illnesses that they just can't seem to get over.
Well, it's certainly better than guessing.
Well, that's my... And Dr. Reardon had a famous quote that I like to tell people. He said, until doctors start measuring nutrients, nutrition will always be a kind of mystical, you know, art instead of a science. And so I think he's right. I think it's been proven to be true in terms of vitamin D. You know, for a long time, people said, oh, don't take more than 400 units of vitamin E, or vitamin D. It's a fat-soluble vitamin. It could build up and really hurt you. Well, no one, you know, there was just one archaic study that kind of indicated that, and no one really questioned it. And now that there's been a renaissance of vitamin D testing, look at what we've discovered and all the uses that vitamin D has in terms of preventing illness, treating illness, reversing diabetes and a number of different things. And so all of these things can have a bearing on the health of individuals. And so I'm hoping that as doctors do start to measure nutrient levels, they'll begin to start making these correlations themselves in terms of patient care.
I wish we had more time. I have a million questions. I want to say this, and then I want to talk about interpretation. But I personally was taking 50,000 units of vitamin D a week. You would think that I would have a pretty good level of vitamin D. And I decided to go and have my lab test done, some testing, nutritional testing the day, and I was almost deficient.
Yeah.
So do you use certain vitamins that you know are very absorbable? How do you make sure that happens?
Well, we have a...
And remember, we only have like 3 minutes, and I do want to
talk about 3 minutes left. We have a vitamin store where we use companies, and because we test, we know which brands are reliable and which ones get the results. So I don't know if it was because you were using an unreliable brand. More often than not, it has to do with that individual. This is that biochemical individuality. You can't guess or you can't use dose alone to predict whether or not a person's going to have enough. And so we have found that over and over again, especially true for vitamin D.
Interesting. So how do you teach people how to interpret what your test means? And if we have what kind of testing, what are all the tests that you have available? And does insurance pay?
Yeah, Medicare pays for the first visit and covers about 75% of the tests that we do. Other insurance companies, it's a lot more variable. Some cover it and some don't. We use the bell-shaped curve, and in general, we're wanting people to be in the plus 1 to plus 2 standard deviation range, which means they've got adequate reserves, and those standard deviations are based upon We do about 70,000 individual tests a year at our clinic. And so over the last 35 years, we've accumulated a very large database. So we really do know kind of where people kind of fall. And I always tell people our database is based upon people who are chronically ill, more or less. There are some, you know, number of healthy people that come in that want to get their levels checked. But we sure see a lot of sick people. So I kind of tell them, we want you in the upper part of the curve if it's a nutrient. Now, there are certain things that you want to have low, but we have our reports set up so that people can understand what they mean and kind of what they need to do to change the direction of their reports so that they're moving in a favorable direction.
Okay. I'm going to give you like 2 more minutes. Is there anything you want to say? I mean, I wish I had. We're going to have you come back.
I want to thank you for inviting me to be on the show. I don't know who's all listening. I know that the message needs to get out that there is a new paradigm of medical care on the move. I'm not the only one. Dr. Alan Gaby just published a 1,400-page book on nutritional medicine. It's got 900,000 words in it. It's got, I think it's like over 10,000 references in it. It's very well done. It's 30 years of work on his part. The research is there. The discipline is there. But we have this strange bias against nutrition in medicine. It's not taught in the medical schools. Our son is a third-year medical student, and he's telling me that he's maybe had 2 hours of his entire first 2 years of medical school where they kind of touched on nutrition. So we need a lot more education of physicians. We need a willingness for the population to look at nutrition as a viable way of helping them deal with their complex medical problems. And we need some insurance to cover that kind of care. But I don't know. The whole system is falling apart, and they just don't feel like they can afford another major hit. And it's not to say that nutrient testing is cheap, but it's reliable, and it gives really good direction to people in terms of trying to find their way back to better health. So hopefully there will be grassroots movement, and more doctors will see the value of doing this kind of work.
And
but again, thank you for having
you
me on the show.
Oh, thanks for coming. Tell me quickly, what tests do you offer?
We measure all the antioxidants, A, C, E, D. We measure all the B vitamins, folic acid, B12, B1, 2, 3, 5, and 6. We measure red blood cell minerals, magnesium, calcium, copper, zinc, manganese. We do all the amino acids. There's like 20-some essential amino acids that we look at. We look at, especially about everyone, we look at the omega fatty acids, omega-6 and 3 and 9, and the trans fats. We measure those. We look at food sensitivity, adverse food reaction testing. We do CoQ10 levels. We look at the standard cardiovascular risk factors, lipoprotein A, the lipid panel, those kinds of things. We do a lot of specialized testing. We do heavy metal testing, mercury, lead, cadmium, aluminum. Arsenic testing. So we basically do a pretty full gamut of all the tests that might represent underlying causes of chronic illness and then try to begin to correct those abnormalities as we find them.
Okay. ReardonClinic.org, is that right?
ReardonClinic.org. Yep.
Thank you so much for taking time.
All right, Eva.
I wish
thank
we had
you for having me on.
Hours.
Oh, well, sometime later we can get back together again.
Good night.
Good night.